It's the Kim Munson Show, analyzing the most important stories.
Socialization of transportation, education, energy, housing, and water. What it means is that government controls it through rules and regulations.
The latest in politics and world affairs.
Under this guise of bipartisanship and nonpartisanship, it's actually tapped down the truth.
Today's current opinions and ideas.
On an equal field in the battle of ideas, mistruths or misconceptions, and it is getting us into a world of hurt.
Is it freedom or is it force? Let's have a conversation.
Indeed. Welcome to the Kim Munson Show. I am Kim Munson. Be sure and check out my website. That's Kim Munson, M-O-N-S-O-N.com. Sign up for our weekly newsletter there, and you can email me at kim@kimmunson.com. as well. Go over to Facebook and give us a like. A very important show planned for you today, July 1st. This was the day in 1863 that the Battle of Gettysburg began. And Steve, you were back at Gettysburg this year.
Well, it's very neat the way this came together. We're going to be hearing from our guest later in the show, segments 2, 3, and 4, who was with us last year for July 1, and we talked about this. And then I got a chance to go to Gettysburg. We didn't plan on going actually to the battlefield. Something changed our plans, but I'm glad it did because we spent 5 hours just in the visitor center alone. The battlefield is immense and you have a hard time getting to all the points, but the visitor center brings it all together. And again, 5 hours in one place and I didn't want to leave.
Well, it's truly, truly sacred ground. And you're referring to our guest. We'll be talking with him in segments 2, 3, and 4. Dr. Alan Gelzo, he is an expert. He's at Princeton University, and it promises to be a really rich conversation. And so our quote for today, Steve, has to be the beginning of the Gettysburg Address, where Lincoln said, 87 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. And it's so astonishing that we're seeing this division in our country now. And Lincoln knew that we needed to keep the country together. And, you know, we fought a civil war on that. And then also whether or not one man could own another, that there could be slavery. And we settled that question as well. And so it's amazing. The words of the Gettysburg Address are just amazing, but it was to honor the dead who fought there that day.
Maybe we can get Dr. Gelzo to talk about that to a degree.
You think?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I remember he was so enlightening last year when he was on the show with us. And I took that stuff with me and I was sharing it with the other people in my party, some of the things that he had shared with us on the broadcast last year. So let's see where it goes.
Well, you know, one of the things that he said last year is if they had not stood and won, if the Union Army had not stood and won at Gettysburg, who would there have been to fight in World War I to free Europe or in World War II? And that stuck with me all year as well. So I can't wait to have the conversation with him, Steve.
Somebody, what you just now said, somebody might be scratching their heads and saying, well, how can you connect those events? He did. And you really got to understand what the outcome of the Civil War really meant to this country. And had it gone the other way, what would have life been like? What would the nation have been like?
Yeah. You know, indeed. And Steve, just like in Gettysburg or at our founding, it's always a question of two different ideologies. And what we're facing right now is an ideology of destruction or on the other side of freedom and liberty. And America was founded on this idea of freedom and liberty. And so it is our time to understand these principles and talk about them. So on the line with me is a couple of my really valued sponsors and partners, and that is Lauren Levy with Polygon Financial Group. He is a mortgage specialist. And then Karen Levine with RE/MAX Alliance. She is an award-winning realtor. And, you know, Lauren Levy, this is one of my most favorite holidays, weeks of the whole year, and that is celebrating Independence Day. In the next three segments, we will be talking with Princeton professor Alan Gelzo. He's an expert on Gettysburg because today, July 1, is the day that the Battle of Gettysburg began. And so what's your thoughts just as we're coming into Independence Day, Lauren Levy?
Well, I think it's it's an interesting holiday, especially this year with all that's going on with the different movements and things, and it really gets you thinking back to what Independence Day is really about, and you know what our founders were trying to break free from and develop here as a country with, you know, all the different rights and things that they wanted to have for people. It just makes me do a lot of thinking, is really what I would say about this year.
Well, Karen Levine, I'm with Lauren. I mean, I never would have dreamed last year as we were celebrating Independence Day that we would be where we are today. And so it's such an important holiday. What's your thoughts on it, Karen Levine?
Well, I think that, I guess I hope that that we will, as citizens of the United States, that we will reflect on why July 4th is so important, why we celebrate that day, and we celebrate it for independence from England and from the tyranny of England and from the taxation of England. And I think it's important that we help our youth and our young people to re-engage in why the 4th of July is a holiday and why we celebrate what was the beginning of creating the United States and how we are a free people. And right now, we're probably not feeling very free.
Well, and it is an ideal worth protecting. And Karen, to your point, it's so important to let our young people know about this. And all three of us are entrepreneurs. You both are just such treasured and valued partners of mine. I so highly recommend you. But we're entrepreneurs, and that's somewhat unique in the context of governments, that everyday people can go out and create businesses. And so all three of us really appreciate the freedom to do that. And so, Lauren Levy, if people want to reach out to you, I'd highly recommend it to do a mortgage checkup. Your phone number is 303-880-8881. And I really appreciate it. What's your final thought today, Lauren Levy?
My final thought today is that I really want everyone to enjoy the holiday over this week. Think about, just like Karen said, why we celebrated in the first place. And also realize that there are opportunities that come through periods of negativity or periods of change for some people. And, you know, so I encourage people to call and see if they can turn something that seems maybe not like the greatest situation into something that is really a positive for them. And one way to do that would be to see if they could save money or time on their loans or, you know, purchase a property as well. So I would encourage everyone to reach out.
And your information, both of you have landing pages on my website. So Lauren Levy, thank you so much. And Karen Levine, what is your final thought for the day?
I would say, Kim, is to remind each and every one of us that one of the greatest privileges as an American we have is home ownership. And that home ownership develops wealth in our households and creates stability. So if you're thinking about becoming a homeowner or thinking about changing your current home, I would hope you would reach out to me. I will be available, and my number is 303-877-7516. And I wish everyone a safe and happy holiday.
Well, Lauren Levy and Karen Levine, thank you so much. And before we go to break, go over to Hooters Restaurants. You can now dine in. You can sit out on the patio. You can have a great beverage, wonderful nachos, some of their great wings. Hooters Restaurants is one of my valued partners, and they have 5 locations: Loveland, Westminster, Aurora, Lone Tree, and Colorado Springs. They're open for dine-in, to-go, delivery, and curbside service. And they run specials. Wednesdays are Wings Day, all-you-can-eat for $15.99, so you might try that out today. They have lunch specials Monday through Friday. Kids eat free, dine-in, or to-go. So go to my website to get more information, or you can go to order.hooters.com. That's order.hooters.com, and we'll be right back.
Karen Levine has over 30 years in the real estate industry. The reaction to the COVID-19 Wuhan virus is presenting unprecedented and unpredictable opportunities and challenges in buying or selling your home. That is why you need to work with award-winning realtor Karen Levine. Karen Levine comes highly recommended by Kim Munson. Call award-winning realtor Karen Levine today at 303-877-7516. Karen's expertise will help guide you through this crazy real estate market. Call Karen Levine at 303-877-7516 today.
All of Kim's sponsors are an inclusive partnership with Kim and are not affiliated with or in partnership with KLZ or Crawford Broadcasting. If you would like to support the work of the Kim Munson Show and grow your business, contact Kim at her website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim Munson, M-O-N-S-O-N.com.
Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. Trampling out the vintage ware.
Welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. Be sure and check out my website. That's Kim Munson, M-O-N-S-O-N.com. Go over to Facebook and give us a like. You can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. And be sure and sign up for our weekly newsletter. We highlight all of our upcoming guests, as well as our new Sounding Off with Kim Munson podcast and all of our op-eds. I am so excited to have on the line with me Dr. Alan Gelzo. He is a senior research scholar and the Council of the Humanities Director Initiative on Politics and Statesmanship, the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions at Princeton University. He is an expert on Gettysburg. And the Battle of Gettysburg began on July 1, 1863, wasn't it, Dr. Gelzo?
That is correct.
Okay. And it was fought July 1 through July 3. It is just really great to have you on the line, Dr. Gelzo. So, welcome.
Well, it's good to be back and talking to you, Kim, and to all of your listeners there in Colorado.
Now, you're an expert on Gettysburg, and we want to talk about that. However, Dr. Gelzo, from last year to this year, I would never have dreamed that America would be where we are, tearing down our statues and our monuments because we're not perfect. What's your thoughts on this, Dr. Gelzo?
I weep over what we are doing to ourselves, because for one thing, it represents so much thoughtlessness, and for another, it accomplishes so little of any good and does such terrible harm. When we look at the landscape of monuments, what are monuments there for? Monuments are there to remind us of the past, because the past fades. I mean, our own lives fade. We are not the people that we were 10, 15 years ago. And what do we hold on to remind ourselves of what we have been, of where we have been? Sometimes we purchase little knickknacks and we put them in a curio shelf. Sometimes we have larger things and we put them out in the house, and when people come to visit, we point to them and say, I was at that place. I visited England. I climbed steps of the Eiffel Tower. And those are ways, tangible ways, of remembering who we were and letting our lives not just disappear. And that's what we do in a larger sense as a nation with our monuments. Because the past does fade quickly. And what we need is that physical, tangible evidence, that reminder that some great event occurred here. Something changed in the lives, not only of certain individuals, but of an entire nation. And we need those monuments. We crave those monuments. And now to take this indiscriminate hand to them and smash them is, in a way, first of all, an attempt to erase memory, as though we are ashamed of what we have been as a nation. Every nation has something that's ashamed of. But in our context, alongside our shame, there is much that we have to be proud of. And it is the pride which seems to have been the principal casualty, not the shame, in this latest round of statue smashing and statue toppling. The other thing is that by destroying these monuments, we are in a way committing a kind of invisible murder, because we are taking the life that is caught and imaged by those monuments and destroying it, which is to say, we're denying the life of the past any breath, any living substance, any reason to continue among us in the present. And in a way, that is a kind of metaphorical murder. And on both of those grounds, I think we have a great deal to regret. You know, it is said, according to the curators of the Tate Gallery in London, that at the time of the English Reformation, something like 90% of England's medieval religious art was destroyed. Stained glass windows, statues, paintings, destroyed. Destroyed by zealots who thought they had very good reason for doing what they did at the moment. And yet, when we look back at it, we hit our foreheads with the palm of our hands, and we say, what were they thinking? Statue destruction, iconoclasm, always feels good at the moment. It's always of the present tense and usually occurs in mobs, but it's never reflected upon with any kind of pleasure or joy in later times. And I wish that those who are the statue destroyers today would reflect on how we remember the iconoclasts of the past. We don't remember them with thanks. We don't remember them with gratitude. We remember them with contempt. And contempt will be the portion of the statue smashers of our own time. And it will not take long for that contempt to make itself felt.
Oh, my gosh. What can we do to stop this?
We can, first of all, keep on putting up statues. We can quite stubbornly refuse to be cowed by the image smashers. And we can protect the statues. Sometimes it may be just simply our own self-appointed groups of friends who, when they know a monument or a statue is in danger, simply congregate around it and stand around it. I do not mean people with arms in their hands threatening to be vigilantes. I mean simply citizens, quietly, peacefully, linking their arms, standing around, offering themselves as the protection in their own lives in the present for the lives represented in the past. Those whom the monuments represent deserve a hearing. They deserve a little bit of life from us to maintain the life that they gave to us. And I think there could be nothing more eloquent than when a mob descends with the purpose of destroying a statue. Citizens who really take seriously the term citizen will turn out and they will encircle that monument. And without saying a word, without replying to insult and baiting, stand there linked arm to arm, and they will simply offer themselves first before they will allow the life of the past, their past, to be erased. I don't think there could be any resistance more meaningful or more eloquent than that.
Well, indeed. We stand on the shoulders of giants with this great American history that we have. And these men were not perfect men. That's another thing, Dr. Gelzo, that I see as this demand for perfection for these the men that these statues represent. And there's no room for any grace or any forgiveness because every one of us has imperfections. But the mobs are demanding perfection out of these men that these statues represent. And as you mentioned, they are looking at the things that were shameful about, but not looking at the pride. It's not the whole picture. And then you also said these statues deserve a hearing. And if we talk about the life of that person, it's almost a due process. And through that hearing, we can learn. You know, people are not perfect, but we can strive for excellence. America is not perfect, but we strive for that excellent vision of every man is created equal with these rights from God of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And so this is, I never thought about it. These statues, these men, they deserve a hearing, a due process. And in that, we could learn.
Abraham Lincoln talked about equality, and he dealt with an immediate objection, one which is made today by statue smashers, that equality has never been realized in the life of our country. But Lincoln said, what did that mean when it says in the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal? It was set there as an aspiration. It was set there as a goal for us to aim at, to work towards. And it was also put there in the Declaration to be a reminder that when some people would come along later, as they did, and deny that there was any such thing as equality, that phrase would remain there as a nut on which they could crack their teeth. So it is an aspiration, but it is also a protection. I've been a teacher of history all my life. And in the habits of the decades, I've become imbued with the instincts of a history teacher to explain the past. That's what I do. If I could, I would set down for these people my apprehensions about the wisdom of these new Taliban, these new canting Puritans, these witch finders whose psalm singing praises set out the glories of death rather than life. They are dowsers of offense, and their passion for smashing statues and images is suspect for being the great passion purely of the present tense. I'm not sure that even reasoning like this will make a worthwhile indentation in their purpose, because the people that do this, they are children of the will, not the reason. And like the children of another will in that festival stadium at Nuremberg, they yearn for the drunken embrace of communal madness. I want to say that there is a calm and reasonable process for understanding history, monuments, statues, plaques, symbols. There's even a moment in life when such things can be replaced and be renamed and be repurposed. But understanding is not the aim of the people that I see at work today. And life is not their object either. In Solomon's Proverbs, the figure of wisdom says, all they who hate me love death. And it's this hatred, this love of death, that I see staring out. Death for the past. I see that staring out from every one of the faces whooping around all of the fallen statues. And that should really chill us all.
Well, on that note, that is a lot to think about. So let's go to break. This is Kim Munson, and I'm talking with Dr. Alan Gelzo. And he is with the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions on the Initiative on Politics and Statesmanship at Princeton University. He's an expert on Gettysburg, the Battle of Gettysburg. And the Battle of Gettysburg started in 1863 on July 1st. So we're going to go to break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation with Dr. Alan Gelzo. Hey, before we go to break, Jason McBride, Presidential Wealth Management. July 1, we're coming in on Independence Day, and you always have great quotes when we have these special weeks. What's on your quote list today, Jason?
Well, you know, it's kind of funny. We were together at the Three Punches to Knock Out Democratic Socialism mm-hmm. last week, and Paul Prentice was there. And he's an economist. Apparently, he said he started under Carter, but then he was an economist also under Ronald Reagan. And it reminded me that Reagan had some great quotes on economists. I'd love to ask Paul if he's the one that caused Reagan to make these up and have some fun with him. But, you know, one of Reagan's quotes was, an economist is someone who sees something happen and then wonders if it would work in theory.
Very good.
So that one's pretty good. And he had another one about economists. I think he said, I'm gonna hire an economist that only has one arm, so when he makes a prediction, he can't say, but on the other hand.
Oh my gosh, you know, that first quote again, give that to me, because I'm thinking that also would be like the CDC and all these people that closed everything down. So what was that again?
That's pretty good. He said, an economist is someone who sees something happen and then wonders if it would work in theory.
Yeah. Well, I was kind of thinking of all this modeling, this crazy modeling they did on the COVID-19 thing. And now that, you know, now that we're going through that, we're looking back and we saw how far off the modeling was on all that stuff.
Well, and you see that a lot, not just with economists, but, you know, even with like scientists sometimes, mm-hmm. that they've got everything figured out. You see that a lot, like about outer space and the planets and gravity and all the, oh, we thought we had it all figured out. Now our minds are just blown. Mm-hmm. And you think, well, but they were so sure about this for so long.
Right.
And that's not knocking science. You know, that's a tough job figuring out stuff like that. But you're right, Kim. How many times have we seen models? I mean, according to the scientists that were along with Al Gore, we should all be dead already.
I know.
And now, luckily, we have another 11 years left now, because it was 12 years a year ago, so it's 11 years. I'm going to live it up for the next 11 years. How about you? Yeah.
Well, I hadn't thought about it. I'll get back to you on that. How's that, Jason?
Okay, well, don't waste a minute because you have little time left. Don't forget.
Okay. And Jason, I would really recommend that people sit down with you and your colleagues over at Presidential Wealth Management. I know that we're in holiday week, but once we get through that, you know, people are going to get back to work. And, you know, just make sure, do an economic check to make sure everything's where it needs to be.
Well, yeah, and we've had some interesting times in the markets recently that may have shook people up a little bit. I know this is sound like a broken record, but that doesn't mean it's not valid. You know, again, if you were, you know, losing your lunch a couple of months ago or freaking out when the market was down, saying to yourself, oh, I never want to go through that. Well, it's back up most of the way now, so it's almost like you're getting a chance to do a do-over. Which, you know, you don't get second chances like that too often.
Not too often. So, yeah, give Jason and his colleagues a call over at 303-694-1600, 303-694-1600. Or, Jason, we have this great landing page together, airpresidential.com. That's airpresidential.com. Jason, thanks so much. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Have a great show, Kim.
Predovich & Company understands that the COVID-19 Wuhan virus disruption has individuals and businesses scratching their heads with a variety of bookkeeping, tax planning, and accounting questions. Predovich & Company knows that you need trusted professionals to help you navigate these choppy waters. Kim Munson highly recommends Predovich & Company. Because of their advanced technological capabilities, Predovich & Company can help clients anywhere in the United States. Call Predovich & Company at 303-791-3000 to organize your personal and business finances. Call 303-791-3000 today.
Now more than ever, it is important to have independent voices bringing truth and clarity to the issues facing us, our families, our communities, our state, our nation, and our world. The Kim Munson Show is one of those important voices. Kim is a truly independent entrepreneur. She purchases her broadcast time, which gives her total freedom in production of the show and scheduling of guests. If you'd like to support The Kim Munson Show, go to her website, Kim Munson, MONSON.com, and click on the contribute button under Kim's picture. Kim greatly appreciates your help and support.
My country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing.
Welcome back to The Kim Munson Show. I am Kim Munson. Be sure and check out my website. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com. You can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. And go over to Facebook and give us a like, and also at my website, sign up for our newsletter. On the line with me is Dr. Alan Gelzo. He is an expert on the Battle of Gettysburg, which we're going to get to that. We had him on last year on July 1 as well. But we're talking about these statue smashers. And Dr. Gelzo, what do we say to these people?
Well, sometimes it's difficult to say things because these are not people who are functioning by reason. They are functioning by the madness of the mob. So maybe it's time to lay aside reason. Maybe it's time to lay aside dispassionate objections that, you know, the actual history of the monument they're trying to destroy doesn't really bear any relation to the kind of meaning that they insist it has. So maybe we need to speak to the destroyers themselves. And if we do, I think we have to say two things. First of all, we have to say, you are liars. You who are destroying this particular statue, you don't know anything more of who this statue represents than you know about the life of clouds. You worship your own hatred. And it is really the fear of your own shallowness of soul that leads you to hang loathing around the neck of history. And I want to say to them, I think we should say to them, come and tell me, what is your argument with Washington and Lincoln and Jefferson and Churchill and all the others who've been the object of statue destruction? Tell me what your objection is. Tell me what the footnotes are. Tell me what sufferings these statues inflicted on you yesterday or the day before or the year before. Because, you know, it won't take long. It won't take long. And then when they do that, let their frustration tell them its own opinion of themselves. The other thing that I would say to them is, you are cowards. The real Churchill, the real Lincoln, the real Washington, whose statues have been toppled, Washington in particular, the real Washington survived 4 bullet holes in his uniform at Braddock's retreat. He personally rallied his Continentals under British musket fire at the Battle of Princeton. He even faced down his own officers at Newburgh when they contemplated treason against the infant United States. But all that these people could do was to attack a lifeless piece of stone. And I think of those words of Shakespeare, "Oh, brave new world that has such people in it." You know, all that would have been necessary, Kim, all that would have been necessary is, as these mobs huddled in the darkness, because they always come with darkness, all that would have been necessary was for a kind of Jean-Louise Finch. Do you remember this scene from To Kill a Mockingbird? Jean-Louise Finch steps out from the shadows. This mob of lynchers has shown up in the middle of the night at the jail where Jean-Louise Finch's father, Atticus Finch, is sitting as the sole protector of the man, Robinson, in the jail. And they're not listening to Atticus Finch's lawyer-like objections. But out of the darkness steps 10-year-old, I think she was 10 years old, Jean-Louise Finch, Scout Finch. And she says to the leader of this group, picks him out from the crowd, "Hey, Mr. Cunningham, how's your entitlement getting along?" At that moment, he had to assume the outline of a human being. He had to become, once again, an individual with moral freight. And if we could have a moment like that, if the Jean-Louise Finches among us could step out from the shadows and say to the monument destroyers, "Hey, Mr. Cunningham, how's your entailment getting along?" They would have slunk away like Walter Cunningham, abashed at ever having surrendered their individuality and their personality. Their problem is they have wiped away their humanity and replaced it with something horrible. They've wiped away their past in the name of a better future, as they claim. But they don't know that the future is full of indifference, while the past is filled with life, even in all of its irritations and woundings and imperfections. I have not forgotten the past. I am a history teacher. I bear witness against them. I shame them. And I think that is what we have to do in cases like this.
Powerful. Okay, Dr. Gelzo, let's change gears just a little bit. In a way, it's another monument, and that is Gettysburg. I've just been there once, and it was a very quick trip. I was driving from New York back to Colorado, and we didn't have a lot of time. But as I was at Gettysburg, I felt that this is sacred ground. And then in 2016, I was at Normandy, And I again felt this is sacred ground. So let's talk about Gettysburg. 1863, the battle began. What would be the big overview you'd like our listeners to know about?
In the summer of 1863, the American Civil War is 2 years old. It is hanging in the balances because the forces of the United States, and at the head of those forces is the 16th president, Abraham Lincoln, has been struggling to subdue the Confederacy, this breakaway Southern Republic established for the protection of slavery. And if the war hasn't gone at all evenly, in the West there have been some victories, but there's still stalemate in the Mississippi River around Vicksburg. What's worse is that in this summer of 1863, the principal Confederate field army, under its brilliant general, Robert Edward Lee, has now lunged up into Pennsylvania, lunged into Northern Territory. If Lee's army can trigger a battle with the principal Union army, the Army of the Potomac, and win, that will force the North to the negotiating table. And once the negotiating table is reached, it's inevitable that Confederate independence is going to get recognized. Because once the shooting stops, after 2 years of war, once the shooting stops, no one's going to go back to shooting. But even if there's no big battle, the idea that Lee and a Confederate army can run around Pennsylvania unobstructed is going to do untold political damage to the Lincoln administration. And in the North, the public is weary of this war, weary of its costs. And it is entirely possible that the political pressure, I mean, leave aside the military aspect, it's entirely possible that the political pressure exerted by a Confederate army roaming at will would also force the Lincoln administration to negotiations. That is what Robert E. Lee and the Confederates are hoping for. They move up into Pennsylvania, and on the 1st of July, they encounter the lead elements of the Army of the Potomac, just to the west of the south central Pennsylvania town of Gettysburg. It's not a planned encounter. The Confederates had hoped to concentrate around Gettysburg on the 2nd of July, the 1st and the 2nd of July, and there be prepared to receive an attack by the Union Army. The Union Army gets there a day ahead and triggers the battle prematurely. But it doesn't go well for the Union forces because they're scattered. They can't concentrate sufficiently. And at the end of the day, the Confederates have pushed them away from the town, through the town. By the time darkness falls, the Union forces have lost nearly half of their strength, and they're just clinging to a hill south of Gettysburg called Cemetery Hill, because that was where the town cemetery was located. And all the odds looked like the next day, the Confederate Army would just finish the work that it had done on the first day of the battle. When the second day of the battle begins, things have changed, because elements of the Army of the Potomac have come up in the night. They have arrived at Gettysburg through the darkness. And when Lee looks at the prospect of completing his first day's victory, there's going to be more work to be done than he had originally thought. So he launches this gigantic, sweeping flanking attack, catches the Union Army by surprise, almost crushes the left flank of the Union Army. Time and again through that afternoon of July 2nd, the battle trembles in the balances, and time and again, junior officers, a regiment here, a brigade there, operating on their own hook, not of direction from brilliant generals or anything like that. Time and again, ordinary Union soldiers, line officers, companies, they make these spontaneous decisions about how to deal with the oncoming disaster. And over and over and over again, Kim, they make the right decision. They make the right stand. And against all the odds, they hold off the Confederate avalanche. But they're still holding on only by the skin of their teeth. And when the third day of the battle dawns, 3rd of July, Robert E. Lee's Confederates still have one entire fresh, uncommitted division to throw into the battle. And they do that. It is a division of Virginians under George Pickett. And together with another motley division of North Carolinians and Tennesseans, they launch one final great attack aimed right at the nape of the neck of the Federal position holding Cemetery Hill and Cemetery Ridge. Okay. And it comes within an inch of success, but it fails.
Okay, that's going to be our cliffhanger. We're going to go to break. This is Kim Munson. I'm talking with Dr. Alan Gelzo. He is the director of the Initiative on Politics and Statesmanship at the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions at Princeton University. He is an expert on Gettysburg, and this is absolutely fascinating. We're going to go to break. We'll be right back.
Recently, rates in the mortgage market have hit near record lows. Lorne Levy with Polygon Financial notes that the COVID-19 Wuhan virus disruption has created potential opportunities to refinance your mortgage that could save you thousands of dollars. And for those senior listeners who may be looking for another source of income, exploring a reverse mortgage with Lorne Levy may be a solution. With over 17 years in the mortgage industry, Lorne Levy has the experience to answer your questions. Call Lorne Levy at 303-880-8881. That's 303-880-8881 for a mortgage checkup today.
Today, July 1, 1863, the Battle of Gettysburg began. It was fought July 1 through July 3. And on the line with me is Dr. Alan Gelzo. He is an expert on Gettysburg. He also is the director of the Initiative on Politics and Statesmanship with the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions at Princeton University. So, Dr. Gelzo, before we went to break, we're talking about Day 3 and Pickett's charge. So take it from there.
Pickett's charge wasn't solely Pickett's charge. George E. Pickett commanded a division of three Virginia brigades. They were fresh. They hadn't been part of the battle, whereas the Union troops that they were facing had been pretty well worn down by the fighting of the previous 2 days. Pickett was going to be blended together with a haphazard division of North Carolinians and Alabamians and Tennesseans who had been through fighting in the previous 2 days. So their ranks were somewhat depleted. Their organizational structure had been knocked around rather badly. But nevertheless, they were going to add numbers to Pickett's fresh division, probably something in the range of about 14,000 to 15,000 men. And Robert E. Lee was going to launch them in a great single attack that he believed would be the final note of the battle. For 2 days, the battle had been going on, and to all appearances, it seemed as though the Federal Army of the Potomac was on the ropes. Of its 7 infantry corps, 5 of them had been pretty well put out of action. 1 was being held in reserve, and the last one that was holding the back door, so to speak, to Cemetery Hill, was really down to just 2 brigades, and they were not in the best of shape anyway. They were maybe 3,500, effectively, 3,500 Union soldiers holding that back door to Cemetery Hill, and they were going to have to hold that ground against the onset of those 14,000 to 15,000 Confederates.
Hmm.
Almost nothing happens that morning. There's some desultory fighting over on the other side of Cemetery Hill, which is something of a distraction action. But that peters out around noon. At 1 o'clock, signal gun fires from the Confederate side, followed by a second. Those two cannon shots were the moment. They were the drawing up of the curtain for an enormous artillery barrage to be aimed at those Federal soldiers holding that back door to Cemetery Hill. Something like 170 to 180 pieces of artillery firing together for an hour. They made the loudest noise ever heard on the North American continent. The artillery barrage could be heard across the Susquehanna River in Lancaster. In the streets of Philadelphia, people could put their hands on the trolley rails in the streets and feel the vibration. After an hour, the barrage stops. Out from the woods steps Pickett's division and the accompanying division in perfect serried ranks. Up and down the Union line, the whispered words, "Here they come, here they come, here comes the infantry." And the picture did not look good. Across almost a mile of ground, it takes maybe 19 to 20 minutes for them to cover it. This Confederate wave comes almost as irresistibly as a tsunami. Federal artillery tears holes through these beautiful lines, but the holes are immediately made up. On they come. They cross the Emmitsburg Road right in front of the Union position. They dress their lines, and they make their final rush up to the Union position. And there it dissolves into a swirling mass of hand-to-hand fighting. One Union unit is pushed back against a small clump of trees. Another unit is peeled back in the other direction. And for a moment, it appears that there is daylight for the Confederates to pour right through the Union line. And if they do that, then the entire Union position collapses. Cemetery Hill has to be abandoned. The Union Army, the Army of the Potomac, has to head down the Baltimore Pike for safety in retreat to Westminster, Maryland. Standing in that path is a unit here, a unit there, and the 72nd Pennsylvania Volunteer Regiment. The color bearer of the 72nd steps out in front and says, "Who will follow the colors of your regiment?" And he steps forward, and the whole regiment lurches behind him, and they move down and smack right into the oncoming Confederates. The lead Confederate general, Lewis Armistead, goes down with a wound. The momentum dissipates from the Confederate attack. And almost before anyone realizes it, the Confederates have fallen apart. They've run back over the wall they had overrun and are now in full retreat back to the woods from which they came. And as they do so, their commander, Robert Edward Lee, meets them as the fragments of these divisions come out of the boiling smoke of powder and artillery. "This is all my fault," he says. "This is all my fault." He had gambled everything on this attack, and the gamble had failed. That night, it rained, as it so often did after Civil War battles. It rained in buckets upon buckets upon buckets, as though the heavens themselves were weeping. And Lee summons one of his officers to his tent, John M. Bowden, and puts him in charge of the retreat of the Confederate Army back to the South. The next day was Saturday, the 4th of July. It could not have been more appropriate. And when the news comes to Abraham Lincoln in Washington, it comes in accompaniment with fresh news from the West that the last Confederate citadel on the Mississippi River, Vicksburg, has fallen to a Union army under Ulysses Grant. It is the best weekend of the war for Lincoln. And he greets a crowd of well-wishers at the White House And he gives them an off-the-cuff speech. He was not a man given to off-the-cuff speaking, but he couldn't restrain himself on this occasion. He said, how long ago was it? 80-odd years that we established this republic based on the idea that all men are created equal. And now, this past weekend, on the anniversary of that very document, those very words, the enemies of that document have, as Lincoln said, turned tail and run. He felt there was something almost providential in the symbolism that the that July 4th becomes the day that shows the defeat of the Confederacy, the defeat of the Confederate Army, and the triumph of the principles of July 4th. And he was not really exaggerating, as it turned out, because after Gettysburg, the war will go on for another 20, 22 months. But the fortunes of the Confederacy will spiral steadily, inevitably, gradually, downwards all the way to the surrender at Appomattox Courthouse in April of 1865. And the sun goes down behind South Mountain that 3rd of July, 1863. And as it does, the sun is really setting on the future of the Confederacy. It is the greatest battle in American history, the greatest battle in North America, and it is the great affirmation of our founding principles. So much so that when a cemetery is going to be dedicated for the burial of the dead of the battle, Lincoln is invited to come and give what are called a few appropriate remarks. What he delivers, of course, is the greatest speech ever made by a president, the Gettysburg Address, which he captures not only the purpose of the war, but the whole purpose of the American Republic for which that war is being waged. What a moment, and what a place.
What a moment and what a place is for sure. And you said that he typically did not speak off the cuff, and there's talk or lore about the Gettysburg Address that he kind of like wrote it on a napkin. What's your thoughts on that?
That is pure legend, pure legend. No, Lincoln actually wrote out very carefully a draft of these remarks before he left Washington for the ceremonies. And we know that because he wrote it out on the Executive Mansion stationery. We still have the first, the original page of that. And he took that with him. He got on the train in Washington on the 18th of November, and the train took him to Baltimore, then to Hanover, and then to Gettysburg. But he had the thing already written. Now, what he did do was, when he got to Gettysburg, he was an inveterate tinkerer and editor of his own writing. Lincoln would today be the despair of a magazine editor, because magazine editors like to get someone submitting an article just as the article, and letting the editor do the work. Editors always dread these writers, and I say this with authority because I'm one of them. Editors always dread these writers who are constantly saying, wait a minute, I need to change that, or I want to change that phrase. I mean, editors pull their hair out over that. Lincoln did the same thing. It was always, I can make this a little bit better, a little bit better. So he stays up till midnight scrawling and working on some of this in the room that he occupied in a house on the square in Gettysburg belonging to David Wills, who was the organizer of the cemetery. The next day he goes for a quick tour of the battlefield in the morning, comes back, spends another half hour or so, last minute tinkering, and then he's ready to join the parade that takes him to the cemetery, to the platform, and then delivers the address. But, Kim, you can forget the whole business about Lincoln writing this on the back of an envelope on the train while he was en route. Mm-hmm. Lincoln was so meticulous. He was so careful about his public utterances that he usually would decline opportunities to speak extemporaneously if a situation demanded it. In fact, when he was at Gettysburg, a group of people came to the house where he was staying, asked him to come out and talk, and he said, well, really, I can't say anything at this point. If I did, it probably would be an embarrassment. So rather than try to say something, I'll wish you a good night. Even then, he won't do anything spontaneously. He wants to be extremely careful. He wants to be extremely self-conscious about what he's saying, because he knows that what he says at Gettysburg is going to have an importance that lives much, much longer than Lincoln himself.
Oh, my. Dr. Alan Gelzo, totally fascinating conversation. Thank you so much. Dr. Gelzo is the director on the Initiative on Politics and Statesmanship, the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions at Princeton University. How can people learn more about you, Dr. Gelzo?
Well, they can go to our James Madison Program website, or they can go to my own website. I almost hesitate to call it my own, because it's really my daughter-in-law, my wonderful daughter-in-law, who maintains it. And that's www.alangelzo, all one word, alangelzo.com.
And that is G-U-E-L-Z-O.com. Dr. Gelzo, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate the conversation, and have a very happy Independence Day later this week.
And the same to you and all of your listeners, Kim. It's so good to talk again.
Okay. And our quote for today is Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. He said, "It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth." My friends, today be grateful, read great books, think good thoughts, listen to beautiful music, communicate and listen well, live honestly and authentically, strive for high ideals, and like Superman, stand for truth, justice, and the American way. This is Kim Munson signing off. God bless you, and God bless America.